Today, after hearing about the rising anger in response to the killing of Sarah Everard, we look more broadly at the question of femicide, women killed by men, hear another woman's story, and ask, what would it take to break this terrible cycle of violence? Before we start, a warning. We're about to discuss very violent crime, and there are descriptions that some listeners may find distressing. How long have you been a journalist for?
Oh, I'm 72, so I think about 50 years.
In those 50 years, there has been one subject that Yvonne Roberts keeps coming back to, the killing of women by men.
When I was in my early 20s, I was sent up to Leeds and Bradford to do a story about what was happening in the search for the Yorkshire Ripper.
The narrow back alleys around Bradford's university were sealed off tonight as police made a detailed search of the area. The body was found by a patrolling officer, well hidden behind a low stone wall at the back of a large terraced house in the city's Bedsit area.
What astonished me was, A, the absence of women in any of the public places because there was such a strong fear. And I thought how awful that was, because the one thing that police are supposed to do is to make sure that you're safe and that you're secure.
Detectives have so far got little nearer to revealing the identity of the man who's terrorised the red light districts of northern cities over the past 4 years. Tonight, they're waiting anxiously to find out if he has slipped their net once more and struck again.
And when, at that time, they were talking about, very dismissively, that these women were prostitutes as if they were third-class citizens, I think that started to make women collectively feel that they had to take control.
And so, in 1977, partly in response to the Yorkshire Ripper murders, dozens of women took to the streets of Leeds in what would become the first Reclaim the Night protest.
I was reporting, I wasn't marching with them, although my heart and soul was with them. To see them out on the streets at night, when the police had been telling them very firmly that they should be a curfew and they should be in their homes, was something quite significant.
Significant and long-lasting. As we saw this weekend, when women poured onto the streets once more in response to Sarah Everard's killing.
There is a resonance with the kind of reaction, especially from the police, around the disappearance and alleged murder of Sarah, in that their first response is to look at how women are behaving generally and to try and say, by implication, if you're going home, go home at 9 o'clock at night, make sure you're wearing bright clothes, make sure you don't talk to strangers. And I think the reaction of women to that is very similar to the reaction of women in Leeds and Bradford and the Reclaim the Night movement. It was to say, we will make our own rules and it's for men to change their behaviour. And the way we can do that is with collective strength.
Has the kind of scale of the reaction surprised you?
No, not at all. No, not at all. I mean, I think any woman who has conversations with women friends knows that this is going on at a great rate. And I was flashed when I was younger at least five times that I can think of. And in one case, a man pulled a knife at something like 9:30 in the morning on Clapham Common. You just sort of absorb it as part of the way you're supposed to go about your business. But I think for the first time, the dam is beginning to break. I hope I'm not being over-optimistic, but I think the dam is beginning to break in the Me Too. And also this increasing evidence. We have evidence. What feminists lacked before was accumulative evidence of the scale of what was happening, which is why we wanted to do the End Femicide campaign.
The campaign, launched in The Observer, aims to lift the lid on a culture of misogyny. Yesterday we spoke of women's anger after the killing of Sarah Everard. Today we ask, what can be done to stop an epidemic of violence against women? From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, why are so many women being killed by men? Yvonne, femicide is murder. Why do we need this term?
Well, actually, femicide is the killing of a woman by a man. It's not always classed as murder. Sometimes it's seen as manslaughter. Sometimes it results in somebody being sectioned. So you have to be very careful that you can't say murder. So it's the killing of a woman by a man. As Karen Ingala Smith, who is one of the founders of the Femicide Census, says, unless you actually name something, how do you know how to put it right?
And as you've said, it's nothing new. It's decades old.
Decades old.
And even the pressure has been building for years. Of course, we all remember Jess Phillips, the Labour MP, reading out the names of women killed by men in the past. And she did it again last week in the wake of Sarah's disappearance.
Sonia Kelvey, Marianne Ishmael, Daniela Espirita Santo.
It sounds like there's lots of issues with data here, but do you have overall numbers? Do we know how common
femicide is? Yes, absolutely. In the years from 2009 to 2018, 1,425 women were killed by men, ages between 14 and 100. And this is why data is so important. We know from that that 62% were killed by a present or a former partner. And we also know that one of the biggest areas of risk is after they've separated and left. And the police don't seem to clock that very much. 11 women were killed by grandsons. 119 women, 1 in 12, were killed by strangers. We know that almost half of all the women killed were stabbed. 20%, 1 in 5, were strangled. 278 were 60 and over. And it's extraordinary that even now, the way in which we calculate crime doesn't include women over the age of 74. At 75, you no longer exist as far as these kind of statistics result.
Wow.
So, you know, there's huge, huge amounts of ageism going on. And also, you know, the easiest way, as I was told, the easiest way to kill someone is to choose someone who's expected to die anyway. So if you're 40 and you fall down the stairs, the police are likely to ask questions. If you're 80, they'll probably say, well, she fell and she's old anyway.
Do we know who these women are? Like, are there common threads in terms of demographics?
It affects women of all colour, women of all economic backgrounds, women of all degrees of education. And there are actually disproportionately, for example, women from Eastern Europe in the femicide census. And we're trying to find out why. We don't know why.
Wow.
I think there's also an issue of how representative of women of colour any kind of femicide census can be. They're hidden homicides, if you like. It isn't always picked up that there has been a killing. This is why it's an absolute scandal that we are in the 21st century and we still have all these unanswered questions.
So last Monday, when news of Sarah Everard's disappearance was going viral, I was sitting in the coroner's court in Doncaster, and I was hoping, desperately hoping against hope, that Sarah wasn't going to meet the same violent end that Amy did.
The Amy that The Guardian's North of England editor Helen Pidd is talking about is Amy Leanne Stringfellow. Sadly, one of the statistics we just heard about. Not a woman taken by a stranger, but one of the many more, two a week in England and Wales alone, killed by a current or former partner. Tell me about Amy.
So I've never met Amy Leanne Stringfellow, so I'm relying on the recollections of her friends and her family, who loved her very, very much.
My name is Gemma Louise Hurst, and Amy Leanne Stringfellow is my sister. She was one at lads, but she was one at girls as well, as you can tell from all the girls that came today.
She was 26 years old when she died. She had a six-year-old daughter called Aurora, who was her absolute, the light of her life. She was a completely devoted mum. She'd served in the army for 4 years. That did involve her doing a tour of duty in Afghanistan. When she left the army and had Aurora, she got really into fitness and she trained as a personal trainer. She was an amateur bodybuilder. She got really hench. She won Miss Great Britain in some kind of award ceremony in Norway. She was beautiful. She was bubbly. She didn't take any nonsense. Like her sister Gemma says, she was completely fearless. Like she spent her whole life not being frightened of anybody.
It sounds like her life was going really well.
Yeah. And, you know, if you were to take a look at her Facebook profile, you would have thought that she was living the dream. You know, she had this beautiful young daughter. She'd just been swept off her feet by a new man. And that was only in November 2019. There were photos of big romantic gestures made for her by her new boyfriend, Terence Papworth. He even live streamed a marriage proposal on New Year's Eve when he presented her with this engagement ring, which he claimed was worth £8,000. But nothing was as it seemed.
When did her friends and family start to realise that there might be a problem?
They started to notice, particularly as COVID hit, that Amy was becoming ever more distant. She wasn't replying to their messages. She wasn't replying to their phone calls. They later found out that's because Terence had taken away her phone and was occasionally sending cursory replies on her behalf. I mean, there was one family member in particular, Amy's older sister Gemma, who was suspicious right from the start. She just thought it was too much too soon and she didn't trust him.
I didn't know. It didn't sit right with me from the start. She very quickly was moving into his house. She was going to sell her house. She was driving around in his car. She were wearing his clothes. And that's when we said, why did you say yeah when he asked you to marry him? And she said, you don't say no when somebody asks you to marry him. And I said, that's not the answer you say when somebody asks you to marry him. You say yeah because you want to marry him.
They've been such a close family. They all lived in Doncaster, very near each other. They were always in and out of each other's houses. And COVID sort of made it easier for Terence Papworth to distance her from her family, which is a classic tactic from a domestic abuser. And it was about a month before her death when her family realised that things had taken a nasty turn. He gave her two black eyes and threatened her and Aurora with a shotgun. And she did go to the police a couple of days later, and charges were brought against him. He was charged with assaulting her and he was bailed.
And so if Amy obviously by then knew something was wrong and had gone to the police, what protection can a woman be given at a time like that? What protection was she given?
Well, her family say that the police made clear to her that she wasn't safe, that she and Aurora needed to get out. But Amy wasn't happy with whatever it was that the police offered her. And so she, or the family, asked for help from the army. Although she had kind of officially left the army, she retained strong ties and they found her a safe place for her and Aurora. The family believed and they hoped that that was it. You know, they thought, Amy, she's so strong. She takes no nonsense. No way she's going to go back to him, particularly as she herself had witnessed domestic violence and she had given her own mother an ultimatum to leave her partner. Otherwise, Amy said she was going to leave. So she was aware of domestic abuse and they just didn't think that she would stand for it.
Given that the authorities knew that there was a risk, do the family look back and see failures here?
I should probably make clear at this point that this is the family's point of view and that there are various inquiries and investigations ongoing, including one from the Independent Office for Police Conduct, which is going to be looking at the contact that police had with Amy and with Terence Papworth in the run-up to her death. But their key bones of contention are that after Amy was murdered, Gemma, her sister, and Craig Patterson, who is Amy's former partner and is the father of Aurora, Amy's daughter, then covered a series of really worrying allegations about Terence Papworth. Craig was told that 20 years ago, Papworth broke one woman's fingers trying to remove an engagement ring.
20 years ago.
Another woman apparently accused him of strangling a dog in front of her. There were women who said that they'd moved abroad to get away from him, one to Australia, another to Ireland. And apparently he even was accused of rape and stood trial for rape, but was acquitted.
He was never convicted. And
was he found not guilty?
He was found not guilty. Lack of evidence. And then...
And Amy's sister, Gemma, believes that had the police gone back through their records properly, they would have found multiple occasions in which women had made complaints against Terence Papworth.
She truly believed in the bottom of her heart she could change that man. And I truly wish now that she could have. Because if she could have, she'd still be here. But she'd also still be here if the police had done the job.
There's also a suggestion from the family that after Papworth had threatened Amy and Aurora with a shotgun, Aurora went into her school and told a teacher what happened. As a result of that, social services commissioned a report into what had gone on. And that report, according to Craig, said that Papworth posed a real risk to life. And they cannot understand how a man deemed a serious risk to life was allowed to get bail. It just doesn't make sense to them.
I sit and think about the fact that this lack of communication and lack of thought. I now have a six-year-old daughter that doesn't have a mum because some people couldn't do their job, in my opinion. And that's the frustrating thing.
And they feel angry because, of course, they know what happened next. Can you tell us what happened?
Yeah. Amy went round to Terence Papworth's house. She had left him, but she took an overnight bag. That's what makes it seem that she wasn't there against her own will, that she was trying to make it work. And she'd actually lied to her family about where she was going that night. But if Amy thought that she was going round to Papworth's house to reconcile and make a go of it, he had other ideas. And that night, he murdered her. He slit her throat with a sword. He strangled her. He smashed her head with a broken bottle, and he beat her so hard that a pathologist, after her death, identified 58 separate injuries, including 2 fractured eye sockets. And there were marks all over her body, which showed that there'd been a really fierce struggle. So she had fought for her life. And remember, she was a strong woman, a personal trainer, and she was a bodybuilder. Not only had Terence Papworth killed her, but he had branded his own initials into her body with a knife.
That was not Amy. Amy did not do stuff like that. She didn't. And that is control. Clear as day, that is control.
That is so heartbreaking and terrifying.
Yeah.
What did he do next?
He went downstairs. He locked the door. He got in his car. And he went to confess, along with his mum and his sister. He handed himself in at Doncaster Police Station before anybody even knew that Amy was dead. And on the way, he made a series of calls to friends in which he said, "I've done it." And he tried to justify his actions. He claimed that he was provoked into it, a classic defence from a domestic abuser. And he claimed that she had been goading him, showing him pictures on her mobile phone of 5 or 6 men that she was having sex with. Police examined her phone and never found any evidence of any of these men. It was just lies. He was making lies to justify why he had murdered her in cold blood.
Were there charges against him?
Yeah, he was charged with murder straight away, and he was remanded into custody. And there were a series of court hearings, but it never got as far as a trial. And then on the 22nd of November last year, he was found dead in his cell and he'd killed himself.
I got the phone call and I cried, I sobbed. And at first, I felt guilty. I thought, have we done this? Even despite what this man's done to my sister, have we done this? Have we made this man kill himself? I didn't want that blood on my hands. I didn't want to know that he'd done that because of me sitting in that room and eyeballing him constantly in court. And that's because of the person I am. And the only time it hit me was that night when my daughter went to bed after I'd told her. I told her that day, Terence has gone. He's not in prison anymore. He's gone, but he's not gone to the same place Auntie Amy's gone. She slept a dream. And that's when it hit me, that actually, it were the best thing. She'd struggled to sleep, yeah, for such a long time. It were the best thing if it meant my daughter could sleep easier at night, knowing that she were never going to see that man ever again. And you know, ever since that day, she's never even asked one question about him.
So there will never be a trial. He will never be convicted of murder, even though the coroner at her inquest last week ruled that she was in no doubt that Amy had been unlawfully killed, which is as far as a coroner can ever go, and that Terence Papworth was responsible.
That is so disgusting. And you've mentioned some of the things that the family felt had gone wrong. When they look back on the tragedy for Amy, but the continued nightmare of not having any justice for the murder of their loved one, what do they think could have been done to save her life?
So at the start of May, he was arrested after assaulting Amy and threatening her in Aurora with a gun, and then he was bailed. But then he was bailed a second time after breaching his bail by getting in touch with Amy. And the family firmly believe that had he been remanded into custody instead of being given bail, had the judge known that he had a long history of domestic violence and that social services had done a report at the time saying that he posed a serious risk to life, that the judge would not have bailed Terence Papworth and Amy would still be alive today.
And why didn't they have that information? What is wrong with this system that meant that that wasn't part of the process?
It's not clear yet. Hopefully the report that's being done by the Independent Office for Police Conduct will shed some light on this. I mean, was it communication problems? Who knows? The family want answers and they deserve answers because they've been cheated out of justice in this case.
That man did what he did. The evidence were overwhelming. He knew it. The police knew it. The court knew it. Yet when he died, that were it. It were over. And that's not fair.
They want to make sure that everybody knows he was a murderer. And they say there are still people in Doncaster, there's Terence's friends who say, oh, but there's two sides to every story. Tez was a nice guy, you know, who believed the things that he told them about things that he claimed Amy had done. But there aren't two sides to this story. There's one side to this story, and that's that Terence Papworth murdered Amy Leanne Stringfellow. End of story.
Presumably for the family, the most important thing is Aurora, who Amy loved so much and who is now growing up without a mother.
Yeah. And they've tried their best to be honest and open with her about what happened while protecting her from the full violence of her mother's death. But she knows. She knows that her mummy's in heaven. Gemma, her sister, said, oh, Aurora's very open about it. She'll tell anybody in the street, my mummy's in heaven. And they think that it's only as she gets older that she'll really realise what happened and what has been missing in her life. And the reason that they wanted to talk to the Guardian is that they wanted Amy's life to be remembered. They wanted it on record how much she loved her daughter. And they want justice.
Coming up, what needs to change to stop this pattern being repeated over and over again? Yvonne, we're talking about this right now because of women like Amy Leanne Stringfellow and, of course, because of Sarah Everard. But there are women being killed every week, many of whom we're not talking about. And I suspect that some of those are more likely to be from poorer backgrounds or, as you said, women of colour. Or I'm sorry to be blunt, but women who the media perhaps deem less photogenic. One thing we seem to keep hearing about in these cases is the idea that there were opportunities to save some of these women, but they were missed along the way, including by the police. What needs to change here?
I don't think it is just the police. The real scandal is usually there's several different organisations involved. And if a woman has had a multi-agency support, which is called a MARAC, they will all supposedly have come together to create a safety plan. So it's even more abhorrent, really, that that always seems to break down. And there's two aspects to this. Over and over and over again, we have a situation where a man has a long history of this and not enough people know, or they don't take it seriously enough. And the difficulty is when that is then exposed, the first reflex is defensive. So the domestic homicide review, for example, where there has been a domestic killing, each of the organisations is allowed to make its own report on what it did and where it sort of went wrong. And that's a very defensive process. You know, you need an independent person looking at what these organisations did. It's a pattern that is repeated over and over again.
And after writing about this for 50 years, why do you think it's a pattern that's repeated over and over again?
I think it's happening over and over again for the simple fact that accountability is not part of the DNA of this entire system. The numbers of times I've sat doing a story about police having disciplinary proceedings brought against them, and it's very rare that they will have to pay any penalty. I mean, they might get sidelined for a bit, but it's very rare. And the same is true in multiple examples where major organisations are involved. So going through the House of Lords at the moment is a domestic abuse bill. Amongst its amendments are outlawing non-fatal strangulation, because we know that often can be a precursor to a fatality, the rough sex defence, and the first domestic abuse commissioner, who's called Nicole Jacobs, and she's very, very capable. So she can call a public organisation to report to her within 54 days. That is a very powerful tool. We didn't have that 50 years ago, 40 years ago, 20 years ago, or 10 years ago. So the fight is to make sure she has the right resources to do her job properly.
And beyond this focus on individual incidents, is the kind of overall scale of this? What is driving this more broadly in society?
Obviously, it starts with misogyny, it starts with the patriarchy, it starts in schools, it starts in the objectification of women, and it starts in their economic inequality that puts them at risk because they have to take on risky jobs, they have to be in riskier neighbourhoods. So it's all part and parcel of how we deal with it, if we're really seriously thinking about it. Can I just say one more thing?
Yeah, of course.
What makes change are mothers, usually, who campaign for years to get a change. I was talking to one mother yesterday. It's taken her 8 years for the lessons of her daughter's killing by a man who was twice her age and who had a 25-year record of numerous occasions where there was violence involved. And yet the police would not acknowledge that they had not served her well, nor did the social services, and nor did the children's services, because there was a child of 2 and 3 involved. And I don't see why it has to take over and over again. One mother, they lose half their lives doing it. And it shouldn't have to be like that. Accountability should be part of the system, and it isn't at the moment.
Helen, you've not just been reporting on this as a policy issue, you've been reporting on it as an incredibly human issue, talking to family members and understanding what happened to them. What do you come away from this thinking and feeling?
Yeah, I mean, it's easy when you read the statistics about 2 women every week in the UK being murdered and you think, oh, that's awful. But when you meet a family whose daughter has been murdered in the most horrific way, it really brings it home to you. And I think talking to Amy's family really made clear to me that anybody can be the victim of domestic violence. You can be strong, you can be a bodybuilder, you can be outgoing, you can be known among your group of friends as the one that doesn't take any nonsense, that kind of almost seeks out confrontation rather than avoiding it. And yet, you can still end up being manipulated and cowed and separated from your family and your self-esteem worn down so much that you will try to make a relationship work with a man who's threatened you with a gun.
If that tough girl who toured in Afghanistan, who ran army boot camps screaming and shouting at people, if this can happen to her, it can happen to anyone. And I just think if people can use Amy's story to try to prevent that for themselves, then they should try as hard as they possibly can.
What the case has shown me is that we need much better education for people to recognise the warning signs. And we need the police to understand much better how domestic abuse works. We need the courts to take these issues seriously and to give the men responsible the sentences they deserve. And we need just a step change in society. We need to start looking at this completely differently. Rich, poor, black, white, trans women, all women can be victims of femicide. There's a quote that's really stuck with me from the Centre for Women's Justice. And they said, domestic homicides have become normalised. Our society would never tolerate this number of deaths from terrorism every week. And it's true. We wouldn't. So why are we?
Helen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Helen Pidd and Yvonne Roberts. Helen went to the police and CPS about the concerns raised by Amy's family about Papworth's alleged history of violence. They said they were unable to comment. Do read brilliant reporting by both Helen and Yvonne at theguardian.com. Do in particular look up Helen's latest heartbreaking piece on Amy Leanne Stringfellow. Our love to her family and thanks to them for speaking out so beautifully on her behalf. Yvonne has been spearheading the Observer's End Femicide campaign. It's all really powerful, but I'd especially recommend one article headlined 278 Dead, The Hidden Scandal of Older Women Killed by Men. Do also listen back to Tuesday's episode of Today in Focus, if you missed it, with The Guardian's senior news reporter who focuses on gender and equality, Alexandra Topping. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Courtney Youssef and exec'd by Mithili Rao. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.